Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the efforts underway by Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid to mediate between the Sanders camp and a growing number of senior Democrats who are concerned that Bernie's continuing campaign is hurting their chances of beating Donald Trump. Jim Manley, a senior director at Quinn Gillespie & Associates, who served as senior advisor to Harry Reid for the past 6 years, and before that, 12 years as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy, joins us. We'll discuss Harry Reid's call on Tuesday to Democrats criticizing Bernie, urging them to, quote, "I think we should just kind of lay off Bernie Sanders a little bit, okay?" and Reid's meeting with Jane Sanders on Wednesday, as well as the future of DNC Chair Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who will preside over the Democratic Convention, where she is likely to be booed the minute she bangs the gavel and be less than useful in helping Hillary Clinton win over Sanders supporters in the name of party unity. Then we'll examine the case against Hillary Clinton for her unauthorized use of a private email server and focus on the fundamental issues at stake, which is the privacy and security of communications at the highest level of government that involves state secrets. Robert Morgus, a policy analyst with the New America Foundation's Cybersecurity Initiative, joins us to discuss why the protection of government emails and communications is so lax, making it easy for hackers to breach antiquated and poorly managed systems, as well as the private emails of current and former government employees. Then finally, we'll assess the historic visit of President Obama to Hiroshima on Friday and discuss the criticism coming from all directions, with some upset that Obama has ruled out an apology, while others argue that his call to eliminate nuclear weapons flies in the face of a massive trillion-dollar modernization of the U.S.'s vast nuclear arsenal. Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and journalist Kai Bird, the author of American Prometheus, The Triumph and Tragedy of J. Robert Oppenheimer, joins us to discuss the father of the atom bomb, Oppenheimer's charge that we dropped the bomb on an essentially already defeated enemy. And joining us now is Jim Manley, a senior director at Quinn Gillespie & Associates Public Affairs in Washington, D.C., a 21-year veteran of the U.S. Senate. He served as senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid for the past 6 years, and before that served 12 years as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jim Manley.
Thanks, Ian, for having me on again.
And your former boss, Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid, on Tuesday, he urged Democrats to lay off criticizing Bernie Sanders. And then on Wednesday, he met with Jane Sanders, and they had a long talk. And my understanding is that Harry Reid's been in touch with Bernie Sanders a lot. He was apparently very critical of what happened in his home state of Nevada, where there was a fracas at between the Sanders and Clinton supporters. And then more recently, I don't know what the gist of the conversations are. So without putting you on the spot, do you have any sense of what's going on here? Is Harry Reid trying to mediate between the Clinton and Sanders camp?
He is trying to mediate it. But here's the beauty of Harry Reid. He also said last week he's having more conversations than anyone would ever imagine with Senator Sanders. He's not going to tell anyone about those conversations. So that's classic Senator Reid. He prefers to do his business behind closed doors and on the privacy of the telephone. So I don't know what he's saying, but I certainly am confident that he is trying to get Senator Sanders in a good place, where he can at some point give his full-throated endorsement of Hillary Clinton. Because in the end, for Senator Reid, just like for many Americans, this one's for all the marbles. He's not only looking at the situation with the Supreme Court, but he's also looking at an attempt to keep Democrats to keep the presidency. And, of course, near and dear to his heart, even though he's not going to be in the Senate next year, there's nothing he'd love more would be to have the Senate flip back into Democratic control. So that's what he's doing quietly behind the scenes. As usual, not leaving a lot of fingerprints, but working hard to try and get it done.
Well, of course, the idea that the Democrats could pick up the Senate is based upon the perception that Donald Trump will cause enormous down ticket damage.
Yep.
And that is something that I think the Republicans are quite panicked about.
Yep.
But how do you feel at the moment when Donald Trump is behaving in a very strange and erratic way? For example, down in New Mexico on Tuesday, he trashed the governor, Susana Martinez, who was actually touted as a possible running mate because she's both a woman and a Hispanic. And not only that, she's the head of the Republican Governors Association. And here it is, when the Republicans are talking about unifying the party, here he is trashing this woman. It's crazy. What's going on, do you think?
Well, I gave up a long time ago trying to figure out how this guy maneuvers. Just, you know, less than a half hour ago, he launched another broadside against Senator Warren, called her a big mouse, and again called her Pocahontas. You know, the guy's got no class. What we're seeing is what we're seeing is Donald Trump driving the political discourse in this country to a new low every day. Sure, there's a whole bunch of Republicans that are beginning to rally around Donald Trump, not only on Capitol Hill, but in the K Street corridors and the fundraisers. They are betting that in the end he is going to moderate his positions and strike a chord that's going to resonate in the general election. I'm here to tell you they're going to make a terrible mistake. This guy is not changing. Like you said, referring to Susana Martinez, I have serious concerns about her governorship. I'm not here to defend her. But the idea that he's going to lash out like that to somebody, the governor of the state that he's sitting there campaigning in, is just unbelievable. No other politician would do it but him. He's a one-man wrecking crew, and he's just destroying that Republican Party from the inside.
Well, I guess the question is, though, at a time when the Republicans are divided and even senior Republicans are questioning the legitimacy of their nominee, who's now their candidate, he's passed the threshold, and you've got people like Paul Ryan holding off on his endorsement, etc., this is a time, you'd think, for the Democrats not to be dividing amongst themselves. I mean, how much are they shooting themselves in the foot here with this tension between the Obama camp?
Yeah.
And particularly now that apparently there's been a to and fro between Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders about having a debate. Now, that's pure political mischief, surely. I mean,
I sure think so. I couldn't agree with you more. The only one that's going to benefit out of such a debate would be Donald Trump,
which is why he's suggesting it. Yeah,
exactly. So, sure, Senator Sanders might get a little publicity and get a little oxygen into his campaign, but as sure as you and I are talking about it, the only one that's going to win in the end is going to be Donald Trump. I got to tell you, Ian, in the last week or so, despite Senator Reid's attempts to urge Democrats to cut Senator Sanders some slack, I got to tell you, I've become a little bit more concerned in the last week or so about what exactly Senator Sanders' endgame is here. I am increasingly concerned that he set up a dynamic here with his supporters that even if, in the end, he himself decides to come to the defense and to support Hillary Clinton, many of his supporters are going to think that in some form or fashion, the game's been rigged, they've been jammed, and they're going to sit on their hands and not vote. And that's just amazing to me. Again, all you have to do is look at the Supreme Court and recognize that this is not about just the next 6 years, but it's also about 4 years for a presidency, but this is about the long-term future of the country and, who's going to hold the control of the balance of power with the Supreme Court. So I hope his supporters will, at the right time, come to the realization that the only game in town is to support Hillary Clinton. But I remain a little bit nervous that not everyone's going to go for it. But that's what Reid's trying to accomplish right now, giving Sanders and his supporters some space to try and come to the realization that, you know, that's the only game in town. Who knows what other inducements Reed's throwing out there behind the scenes privately, but because goodness knows he loves to meddle, but you know, that's what he's trying to do here.
And again, I'm speaking with Jim Manley, who's a senior director at Quinn Gillespie and Associates Public Affairs in Washington, D.C., a 21-year veteran of the U.S. Senate. He served as senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid for the past 6 years, and before that served 12 years as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy. Now, the other irritant, Jim, that we should talk about is the chairwoman of the Democratic National Committee, Debbie Wasserman Schultz. She, as the head of the DNC, will be presiding over the Democratic Convention. And given how much the Sanders supporters dislike her and how much there's this dump Debbie movement underway, with Senator Sanders having endorsed her primary opponent and helped raise hundreds of thousands of dollars for him, I can envision when Debbie Wasserman Schultz is on the podium at the convention, when she gavels the convention to order, half the floor is going to be booing her.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. So she needs to do the right thing, take a cold, hard look at the situation, realize she's become a major irritant to many within the party. She's become nothing but a distraction, and she needs to step down sooner rather than later. Now, as you know, and as your listeners know, you know, shortly after the convention, whoever wins, you know, gets the right, usually, to put their person in at the DNC, but that's going to be too late. So this needs to happen sooner rather than later. Whether she's going to do so or not remains to be seen, but again, she has become a distraction, and if that's in fact the case, she needs to consider her options.
So, do you have any inside baseball on the forces arrayed for her and against her? Or, I mean,
reporters in the last couple of days have been struggling to try and find supporters of hers on Capitol Hill willing to defend her publicly. There's not been a lot of support. The fact of the matter is, Reid and Pelosi over the years switch on who. You know, who's going to take the lead in pushing the DNC nomination? This time around, you know, Debbie Wasserman Schultz is a Pelosi person, and it's going to be up to the leader Pelosi to make the final push. But, you know, I'll give her credit. You know, there's been efforts to push her aside in the past, and she's clung to it. So I don't know how she's been able to pull it off, but, you know, there's been serious discomfort in the Obama administration for at least a couple of years over how she's handled things. Not everyone is convinced that as the head of the party, she's looking out for the best interests of the party. Many people think that she spends far too much time looking out for her own image and her own political power base. So, the sharks are circling. The lack of public support is stunning. Only a few members are on the record on Capitol Hill as voicing support for her. But so far, to be clear, many of these criticisms have been quiet, and nothing's going to happen until they decide to go public.
Well, one of her deputies, deputy head of the DNC, Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard, she quit because of she had problems with the way Debbie Wasserman Schultz was handling the DNC, in particular, being in the bag for Hillary, and then Tulsi Gabbard then endorsed Bernie Sanders. And when you mentioned Nancy Pelosi, she was at a press conference, I think yesterday or the day before yesterday, where all of the questions were about Debbie Wasserman Schultz. And Nancy Pelosi looked kind of like a deer in the headlights. She's saying, well, why are we talking about this? Well,
yeah.
But I bet you when she left that press conference, she had to had to think about it, right?
Yeah, I think that's probably, if she hadn't thought about it much before that, it's certainly now near and dear to her heart. Yeah, like I said, there's, I think some members on the Hill have gotten kind of surprised and how much animosity there is for her for the rank and file, but they certainly know more about it now. So,
Well, let's assume then that the writing is on the wall. Just in the last minute or so, Jim Manley, do you think that it's often said that the Democrats managed to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory? It's not going to happen this time. I mean, we've never had anybody like Donald Trump.
No. This race, I can honestly tell you, Ian, that this race has somewhat gone the way that I expected, leaving aside the Trump factor, which I agree is unprecedented. He finds new and unusual ways to define deviancy down, to borrow a phrase from sociology. I mean, he's just cheapening the political discourse. But, you know, the Clinton folks are, the Clinton campaign is going pretty much like I thought. I've been surprised. Glad there's not been a lot of leaks, not a lot of infighting, but the views about her, are pretty much set in stone. They're pretty much baked in. So she's got her, her base, and the fighting now is between a very narrow, small number of, independents and maybe even Republicans aghast at the idea of the idea that Donald Trump's going to be the next president of the United States. So, yes, the bottom line is that I am confident that Hillary Clinton's going to be the next president of the United States. I just am here to tell you it's not going to be always easy, and it's sure as heck going to be close.
And you don't think these State Department Inspector General's report, which is very damning of Hillary Clinton, and the forthcoming FBI report are going to make much of a difference?
I don't. The IG report landed with a thud on Capitol Hill yesterday, but I don't think it moved the needle much. It's true that I probably would have liked to have seen some of those advisors testify to the AG, but I'm not a lawyer and I don't play one on TV, but I understand they wanted to, keep their focus on the FBI. I think there were serious misjudgments here. She should not have ever set up a private server, but I don't think that the FBI is going to go forward with anything.
Well, Jim Manley, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Jim Manley, who's a senior director at Quinn Gillespie and Associates Public Affairs in Washington, D.C., a 21-year veteran of the U.S. Senate. He served as senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid for the past 6 years, and before that served 12 years as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the case against Hillary Clinton for her unauthorized use of a private email server. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Robert Morgus, a policy analyst with the New America Foundation Cybersecurity Initiative, where his work focuses on crisis management, international relations, and cyber risk and insurance. He's also authored reports on sanctions and export control, internet freedom, and internet governance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Morgus.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And a big shoe dropped yesterday, and I think it officially comes out today, the State Department's Inspector General's report on Hillary Clinton's use of a personal email server. And, of course, another shoe will drop with the FBI investigation, about which we know little to nothing. But this is what I don't understand about this whole scandal, if that's what it is, is that at the end of the day, the reason that there's a problem with having a server that's not protected under the State Department is the assumption that state secrets will get loose. So it all comes down to cybersecurity. And my understanding is, first of all, Hillary Clinton's private server was not hacked, whereas the State Department server was. The OPM has been hacked, and all of the dossiers and all of government employees are now in China. And, of course, the Chinese were looking probably for the backgrounds and all the information possible, including fingerprints, photographs, mortgages, everything about people that work in defense and intelligence. The wholesale lack of cybersecurity within the U.S. government, except perhaps for the FBI, the CIA, and the NSA, is so extraordinary that shouldn't we be talking about this? Why are we piling on, even though, you know, it's clear that Hillary Clinton made massive mistakes, and frankly, she's going to pay for them.
Well, I think you bring up a couple of good points. As far as we know, the HRC, the Clinton email server, hasn't been hacked, although that's a bit of a case of he said, she said. The gentleman from Romania who goes by the name of Guccifer, or Guccifer, I'm not entirely sure how he prefers to be called, that hacked Sid Blumenthal's email a while ago and was recently extradited and was going to face trial, though he pled guilty to the hack, has been quoted saying that he also was able to relatively easily and relatively often gain access to the Clinton email. Obviously, this hasn't been confirmed in any way, shape, or form. And like I said, it's a matter of he said, she said. Oftentimes, folks in the community that Guccifer resides in will sort of treat hacking as a game, and to say that you've hacked sort of the most public personal server, which in this case is definitely the Clinton server, is potentially a way to gain some credibility. But I think the broader point about modernizing federal government IT infrastructure and bringing the security up to snuff there is a good one, and it's one that we're attempting to address. I don't know if you saw the proposed IT modernization fund that President Obama came out with in, I think, early April as part of sort of the final push for cybersecurity within his administration.
Well, I know that the President Obama is trying to deal with this problem, but of course nothing was more stark than the launch of Obamacare, which crashed and burned, and that's his signature achievement as President of the United States, at least that's how he sees it. So he was deeply embarrassed by that, and that raises the question about competence of, one, procurement, and two, the cybersecurity people themselves. Now, the most scandalous thing that I just learned yesterday was that the reason the OPM hack happened was that the contractor that was supposed to protect all of this government data on personnel files of all government employees, they screwed up. But after the scandal broke, OPM hired a new contractor, and guess what? A few days ago, they just disappeared. They took down the website and disappeared. They no longer exist. I mean, what the hell is going on here?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's the problem with cybersecurity sort of writ large, to make this a broader conversation, is twofold. We have sort of old legacy systems that a lot of folks are still using. This is particularly the case in the federal government. I mean, they're using systems from the early 2000s that have stopped, that the companies that have produced them have ceased to support, which is a problem, meaning that there's probably a lot of vulnerabilities on the systems. Then the second half of it is the human element. And with the contractors and with the IT security professionals, there aren't that many that are really high quality when it comes to cybersecurity. And it's an education problem. It's an incentives problem, where most of the smart computer folks are heading out to Silicon Valley trying to make a little bit of money, which, you know, you can't blame them for. But it's left this sort of talent gap, especially in the security space. And to sort of exacerbate that problem, when you take computer science classes, even at the sort of college level or the university level, you don't necessarily have to take security courses. Or if you do, it's one or two, and, you know, it's not a huge part of the curriculum, which is something that could change, and I would argue should change as well.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Morgus, who's a policy analyst with the New America Foundation Cybersecurity Initiative, where his work focuses on crisis management, international relations, and cyber risk and insurance. And he's also authored reports on sanctions and export controls, internet freedom, and internet governance. But just to sort of make sure that I'm not letting Hillary Clinton off too lightly here, which some of my listeners have complained about, not that I don't think she exhibited arrogance and a very high-handed attitude and totally dismissed the State Department. As it made clear, she didn't get any permission to do what she did, and she didn't even talk to the Inspector General. But the reality is that the Republicans are going to beat the hell out of this, just like they have with Benghazi. So it's not like she's going to get off without some punishment. And she herself said she regretted it. But I still think at the heart of it, we should be looking at what the real issue is, why people are concerned that she had, and so did Colin Powell, had email on their own private service, because the bottom line here is it's all about protecting state secrets, because these people are members of the National Security Council. And when you talk about, when you put it in the context of state secrets, then you have to look at the broad picture, which is that the most of the government is completely inept, and particularly the State Department.
Yeah, I mean, if we're talking sort of about the pragmatic issue of protecting the data that was on those servers versus protecting data on State Department servers, I'd say there's, you know, a 50-50 chance that either is going to be breached. The thing about Clinton is there is a chance with the Clinton servers, and I don't know about the hardware and who was administering and all that, but if it was administered well, and if the hardware was up to date and the software was up to date, there's a chance that it's a more secure, inherently more secure system. Now there's all these social ways to get in as well, spear phishing and whatnot. But there's a chance that the tech is more secure with Clinton. That's speculation. I don't know how well it was administered, how securely it was administered. But yeah, I mean, there's a chance. And I would say, though, that the fact that there is a Clinton server makes it a high-profile target for anyone who's trying to get to state secrets, and that adds to the threat that it will potentially be breached.
Well, we know that this Guccifer fellow, we certainly know that he hacked Sid Blumenthal, and that's how Hillary's email showed up. She had been trading them with Sid, so there's all these backdoor ways, surely. And didn't he hack into a member of George W. Bush's family, as well as a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, a cabinet officer, and some pretty high-level people? I mean,
that's my understanding of his exploits as well, generally.
Right. And you say that within the world of the underground of hackers, that's a badge of honor, right? The bigger the person you can hack into, the more kudos you get?
I'd say that's generally a trend, yeah.
Well, that's pretty scary, isn't it?
It depends on who you are, I guess.
I wouldn't probably lose too much sleep reading emails hacked from Donald Trump. But on the other hand, if he were president, that's a different matter. And at some point or other, even though one believes in open government and transparency and accountability, there are certain things that you just have to keep secret, like you don't publish the blueprint to an atomic bomb.
Absolutely. And I think that's why a lot of the time and energy of the government, in particular the NSA and Cyber Command, goes towards protecting the most classified and the most sensitive networks and servers that we have. And I actually think rather highly of those groups and their ability to maintain security. The way that the federal government's set up, though, is that generally speaking, each of the executive departments have been, as we sort of hashed out, have been responsible for their own security. I'm optimistic that the IT Modernization Fund will catalyze a little bit of movement in this space. It'll be interesting to see whether it's enough, though.
But how do you deal with the talent problem? That clearly there's talent in the NSA, and one assumes that the CIA has built walls that haven't been penetrated, although we don't know that, and that the FBI has built walls that haven't been penetrated. But we know that just about every other government department, including DHS, is pretty much in the dark ages and very vulnerable, and the State Department's already been hacked, and the OPM's already been hacked, and that's how the Chinese have got dossiers on all of the defense and intelligence people, and this has caused a lot of problems. The CIA has had to pull people out of China. So this is the world that we're in. And you mentioned the lack of talent. I spoke yesterday with Alan Paller of SANS Institute, and he said it's just appalling, the lack of talent. So how do you address that issue? If everybody, if the smart people want to either work for the NSA or for Silicon Valley, how do you get this fund that Obama's put up spent wisely and well?
Yeah, I don't know that there is a short-term fix. You're not going to flip a switch and attract all of these folks to government, partially because of sort of philosophical or political leaning, partially because of the incentive problem that we talked about. When we say that, we really mean money. I think it's more of a long-term education thing. I think we're going to need to tap into the entire workforce, for one. I mean, the vast, vast, vast majority of cybersecurity professionals are white males. That's a fraction of the workforce. I think we need to do a better job of attracting sort of more minority points of view, because you never know what sort of critical thinking can come out of that. But yeah, I think it's a long-term problem, and it's one that, frankly, education is going to play a huge role in addressing.
And what do you mean by that, education? In schools, universities?
I think that universities can play a role. I think that before you get to university, whether it's in middle school or high school, a general level of knowledge about how to use a computer and how to use it securely and how to use the internet and email in a relatively secure manner. The buzzword that gets thrown around here in Washington in particular relatively often is cyber hygiene or computer hygiene, a general baseline level of how to act online and on a computer would go a long way to preventing a lot of these breaches, which really the vulnerability that a lot of breaches end up exploiting is a human one. It's a spear phishing email. It's to get credentials, and then you're into the system, and you can walk around from there, essentially. So in addition to, you know, tapping into the larger workforce to get them into cybersecurity, I think there's sort of a general public awareness that needs to rise.
So, but my understanding of the best hackers that we've learned about who've been arrested, and there's rumors, and I'm sure there's a lot of substance to it, that the NSA and the FBI hire these brilliant young kids who spend their lives in their bedrooms doing all kinds of nefarious things. My understanding is that Edward Snowden himself didn't have, maybe he was even a high school dropout. I don't think he had a college degree, but he obviously had an enormous talent in this regard. So is it really all about education, or are there just some people that are just intuitively gifted in terms of working in cyberspace?
I don't know if they're... There's a generational component to it. I think that most folks in the younger generation sort of grow up online and are intuitively more gifted than perhaps older generations, not to offend anyone. And I do think that plays a role, though I think to really know your stuff, you need either on-the-job training or you need some sort of education. And in a lot of cases, the way you get these jobs is with credentials, and the way you get credentials is through education or courses or certifications. So I think there's a bit of a chicken egg problem there with regards to acquiring talent. Though, as you say, you know, I think you overblow just how much the three-letter agencies pull from grandma and mom and dad's basement. But I do think that there is some of that.
But how would you test the skills? Say you want to hire a whole bunch of people to plug the leaks at the OPM and the State Department and DHS and just about everybody else except FBI, CIA, and NSA, which seem to, we assume, know how to protect themselves. Do you do, you know, a spelling bee type of competition? I mean, would there be a metric to determine who has the talent and who doesn't?
Not necessarily, though. I would say your sort of track record for finding computer and software vulnerabilities is one metric that you can look to. I mean, a lot of folks out there in what we call the white hat hacker community, the folks who are actively testing the sort of security of software and then reporting those vulnerabilities that they find in a responsible way, either to DHS or directly to companies that develop the software. You know, those numbers, whether they're tracked by the individual or tracked sometimes in forums, are a pretty good indication of the prowess of an individual.
But my understanding is that the best offense is immediate defense. Is that how it works?
What do you mean?
Well, in the sense that the millisecond that there's an intrusion, if it's not detected, you're in trouble. I mean, there was a report, I think, that actually came from Edward Snowden, expressing alarm that the NSA had an algorithm that just automatically threw everything at what looked like an intrusion. But when you look at the Sony intrusion, where the North Koreans got in there and were hanging in there for months and months on end, it seems that that's the problem, that if you don't stop it early, it metastasizes within your system.
I would say if you don't detect it early, you face a problem. Definitely. But I would also say that rather than being reactive, the best approach for anyone trying to secure servers would be proactive. And that involves this sort of penetration testing that I'm talking about. It involves making sure that your software is up to date. Any patch that's sent out by the software developer should be pushed immediately. But defense in depth is also a thing, and being able to patrol your networks and understand and realize when there is something funky going on there is very important. And then if worse comes to worst, you take it offline. And if it's offline, generally they're not going to be able to access.
But when you just in closing, though, are you saying that what you need is constant testing of your own system? You always have people trying to penetrate your own system?
That's exactly right. We call it continuous diagnostics and monitoring. And you constantly need to be, and it's not necessarily you, but it's the system administrator or a tool that should constantly be looking at the system, seeing if there's anything funky going on. And that's sort of the algorithm that I think you were referring to that Snowden talked about with the NSA.
Well, Robert Morgus, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Morgus, who's a policy analyst with the New America Foundation Cybersecurity Initiative, where his work focuses on crisis management, international relations, and cyber risk and insurance. And he's authored reports on sanctions and export controls and internet freedom and internet governance. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with an assessment of the historic visit of President Obama to Hiroshima on Friday.
I'm more important in the USA. For the FBI, I'm trained to meet the criminal elite, and I seek out wherever evil resides. I spy. I'm at home in the streets of Rome.
But the Adams here, in spite of hysteria, it flourishes in Utah as well as Siberia. And whether you're a black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. The answer to it all ain't military Adam, like who gets there firstest with the mostest Adams. No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They gotta get together or disintegrate. A whole less truth to be self-evident that all men may be cremated equal.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Kai Bird, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and journalist, whose books include The Good Spy, The Life and Death of Robert Ames, and American Prometheus, The Triumph and Tragedy of J. Robert Oppenheimer. He has authored numerous critical writings on the Vietnam War, Hiroshima, nuclear weapons, and the Cold War, among other subjects. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kai Bird.
Thank you.
And with President Obama's visit to Hiroshima set for Friday, already there's been quite a bit of discussion about the fact that he says that he's not going there to apologize, but he's going to there to call for nuclear disarmament, a global call, which of course he made back some time ago in Czechoslovakia or the Czech Republic, the zero nuclear weapons idea, which many think is sort of a pipe dream. But so there's a conflict going on here where a lot of people are saying, well, how can you call to rid nuclear weapons when you have the guy, you know, a couple of feet from you, the military officer with football chained to his wrist with the nuclear codes in it that could unleash the world's greatest nuclear arsenal? So shouldn't the big guys like the United States and Russia set the example by disarming first as opposed to stopping the proliferation? So where do you stand on that argument?
Oh, well, I think the U.S. and Russia and the major nuclear powers should take the lead. And people should understand that these are not weapons that can be used in any genuinely military sense. their weapons of terror. And, you know, with the end of the Cold War, it's really long past time for us to seize the moment and try to get the world back to a non-nuclear age.
So you have to admit that's a pretty heavy lift, right?
It is. But, you know, Obama is doing what any American president would do. He has to maintain the nuclear arsenal as a deterrent, but he is also on the record of, as you know, supporting the notion of a nuclear-free world. And his visit to Hiroshima is really quite an extraordinary thing. No American president has ever done this. He's being very careful, though, to say that there's going to be, you know, no apologies, no addressing of the history as such. But nevertheless, this is a very, you know, highly symbolic trip. And his mere presence there is going to, you know, send a message that we need to take steps to get to a non-nuclear world.
But Kai Bird, given that you've written the extraordinary Pulitzer Prize-winning book on American Prometheus, The Triumph and Tragedy of J. Robert Oppenheimer, and that about 3 months after the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs were dropped, or the bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that Oppenheimer said that these weapons had been used on, quote, an essentially already defeated enemy. And that's a part of a broader argument that still continues to this day as to whether or not the bombs should have been used in the first place, whether they should have been demonstrated on an island somewhere so that the
right.
Japanese would have come to their senses, or whatever the alternatives were. I know those were the arguments that went on literally within the small group of people who knew about the atomic weapon. And I spent a lot of time with Hans Bethe and certainly a lot of time with Edward Teller, asking him about these kind of deliberations that went on. But at the end of the day, is there any resolution to that argument? And do you think that this visit will either, by the president to Hiroshima, will put that to rest, or will that debate continue?
Oh, I suspect the debate will continue for decades to come. But, you know, there has been some movement in the popular mind. I think among historians, scholars who study this issue, it's the consensus has really grown over the years that this weapon was used on an essentially already defeated enemy, and that even Oppenheimer understood this, you know, within days of the bomb being used on Hiroshima and then Nagasaki. And so the consensus among historians has moved over the last 60 years. And yet in the popular mind, we're sort of still stuck with the notion that the atomic bomb ended the Japanese war, the Pacific War. And it's sort of a, you know, it's a dangerous historical notion, and one that historians are very frustrated with, that in popular perception that the bomb actually had a utility in ending the war, when in fact, you know, all the history now shows just the opposite, that in fact it may even have prolonged the war. The fact that the bomb was coming online may have given President Truman the notion that he didn't have to address the concerns for the Japanese about unconditional surrender and the fate of the emperor. But these are all arguments that historians have gone into in great detail, and there really is a consensus that the bomb was probably unnecessary, and that its use actually poses, even to us today, the use of it on Hiroshima poses to us today a real national security threat, because it ratifies the notion that this is a legitimate weapon of war, when it is not. It's actually a weapon of mass annihilation that could conceivably lead to the use of nuclear weapons generally in a war, and that would, you know, threaten all humanity. So, you know, these are arguments that go on, and they're unending. But among historians who look at the documents and look at the decisions and how they were made, there really has emerged a consensus that the bomb as such, the atomic bomb on Hiroshima, didn't end the war. It was actually the Russian entry into the war 10 days later that persuaded the Japanese emperor and his military generals that the war was over and that they had to surrender.
Right, but the fact that Emperor Hirohito had to be persuaded by the Russian invasion of Manchuria and all the way through to Korea was necessary for to get him to wake up. I mean, if the atomic bombs didn't do it, what did? I mean, he, of course, was preserved by MacArthur, but he, he was a war criminal. And at the end of the day, he was somebody that was living in an extraordinarily rarefied world of, you know, a god emperor in the way that the North Korean dynasty sort of sees themselves today, or at least their people see them. And
right.
If you read any of his correspondence, it was extraordinary how little concern he had for the fate of the Japanese people. He was more concerned about the various trappings of sacred symbols of the emperor's throne, etc. It's pretty disturbing to understand or try and figure out why it was that he got involved with the militarists in the first place, and it was only his voice on the radio that basically convinced the Japanese people that it was over. And that's what it took, did it not?
Well, yes, and this is part of the debate that goes on and on. I mean, at the time, it was American liberals who were arguing to Harry Truman that we had to be tough, we should end the institution of the emperorship and put the emperor on trial as a war criminal for what he had done, the leader of this war machine in Japan that was very aggressive. But it's also true that the argument has sort of flipped in response to the invention of this weapon of mass destruction. The very, you know, liberals at the time in 1945 who were arguing for a hard peace and put the emperor on trial, you know, today realize that this weapon that was used on Japan is actually a threat to our own existence. And so that's the really intriguing aspect of this whole historical argument. And it's just fascinating to see that even the father of the atomic bomb, Robert Oppenheimer, who invented the thing, within days, you know, of its use, when he realized how it had been used on virtually a whole population, a city of civilians, and on an essentially defeated enemy, this plunged him into, you know, a terrible depression. He understood that the weapon, having been used in the first instance on a civilian population, then set a precedent for perhaps it being used someday against America, because he, as a physicist, understood that there was no secret to this weapon. The physics, once having been invented, there was no secret to how this weapon could be constructed. And so now we live in a nuclear age where countries like North Korea have a weapon of mass destruction. So we're still living with this legacy of Hiroshima, and it's a very powerful legacy.
And again, I'm speaking with Kai Bird, a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and journalist whose books include American Prometheus, The Triumph and Tragedy of J. Robert Oppenheimer, and The Good Spy, The Life and Death of Robert Ames. He has authored numerous critical writings on the Vietnam War, Hiroshima, nuclear weapons, and the Cold War, among other subjects. And of course, it's worth noting, Kai Bird, that the Hiroshima bomb was not tested, as opposed to the Nagasaki bomb that was tested. So as long as people, whether they're states or terrorist groups, can get hold of the fissile material, it's not that difficult to make an atomic weapon, unfortunately. But just to sort of suggest a different take on this, the fact that there has not been the use of a nuclear weapon since Nagasaki is due to the nuclear, what they call the nuclear threshold. And surely the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki set that nuclear threshold. They demonstrated, and they were relatively small. I think it's 13 and 17 kilotons. The bombs, almost every bomb in the U.S. arsenal is a thermonuclear bomb, largely because you can get a bigger explosion in a smaller package. And, you know, the cruise missiles have about 220 kilotons. And during the 60s and 50s and through the 70s, both the U.S. and Russia had massive multi-megaton bombs as well.
Right.
So the scale of this is extraordinary. But what is extraordinary is that the nuclear weapon has not been used since Nagasaki. And how do you explain that? My understanding is it is because everybody accepts the nuclear threshold.
Yes. If you're a rational human being, you accept that nuclear threshold. And so some people can argue that the bomb has, quote, kept the peace, that, you know, we haven't had a world war since World War II. And we can't go to that brink without facing the use of nuclear weapons. And that's an apocalyptic notion. So it's the argument is that it's kept the peace. But of course, the flip side of that argument is that, you know, in a world where this technology is available, it's, you know, possible that the weapon could get into the hands of a renegade terrorist group that has a very specific agenda. And, you know, that's a real threat. You know, a stolen nuke, a crude device exploded by terrorists who are intent on making a statement could end up devastating an American city. And there'd be no visible target in response. So it's, you know, living with the bomb is still a very fearful thing. And we shouldn't be complacent about that.
Well, it's my understanding that the U.S., both under Eisenhower during the Korean War and under Nixon during the Vietnam War, did contemplate using tactical nuclear weapons against the North Koreans and the Chinese and the North Vietnamese. And one of the arguments against using the nuclear weapon was that it wouldn't have any military utility. And as you know, the tactical nuclear weapons have been spread down the chain, and they're probably the most vulnerable. If ever a terrorist gets hold of a nuclear weapon, it's likely to be a tactical nuclear weapon. And the argument basically was, from my understanding, is that if you used a tactical nuclear weapon, and one, it didn't particularly do much to deter the enemy, but two, you would, you know, in effect, destroy the nuclear threshold, that it's important to maintain this idea that these are weapons of genocide and they simply cannot be used. So have you ever heard about that argument?
Oh, yes. That's a standard argument, and it's one that we have to grapple with in this world today, as, you know, North Korea has a weapon. Let's say Iran gets a weapon, or maybe there are Iranian politicians today who are making the case to their supreme leader, the Ayatollah, that the best defense is to have a nuclear weapon, just like the United States has, as a deterrent. And, you know, it's crossing the nuclear threshold. Well, it's already been crossed once, and we're gambling that it will never be used again. But that's an enormous gamble. And, you know, our own President Obama is on the record as in favor of negotiating a nuclear-free world. And at the same time, he has authorized, you know, the expenditure of billions of dollars to modernize our nuclear weapons. So, and as he's going to Hiroshima in a very highly symbolic visit, he's, you know, specifically, he and his Japanese hosts are saying, we're not going to address the issue of what happened here 60-odd years ago. But obviously, that's a highly symbolic moment. And Obama is, by going there, he's opening up this debate. And I think very consciously wanting historians and people in general to look at the history, to understand that we've been very lucky over the last, you know, since Hiroshima was first bombed with an atomic weapon. And we're lucky that it hasn't happened a third time after Nagasaki. And we do need to take steps to try to get to a nuclear-free world. It makes no sense to think that we can live with these weapons, that deterrence will last forever. And, you know, so that's, I think that's why Obama's going to Hiroshima in this very highly symbolic visit.
And, of course, at the G7 meeting in Japan, President Obama mentioned that the world leaders have been rattled by the emergence of Donald Trump, who has passed the threshold of enough delegates to, in fact, be the Republican presidential nominee. Just in closing, the thought of somebody so manifestly mentally unstable, with extreme narcissism, with a reckless ignorance of the world. Already Trump has suggested that the Japanese and the South Koreans should get nuclear weapons of their own. You couldn't have a greater contrast, could you, to what Obama's trying to bring to the world's attention and this looming possibility of President Trump?
Right. No, I think that's exactly why Obama is going to Hiroshima. He's trying to restart a debate about our reliance on these weapons. He's not going to, as a politician, he's not going to revisit the history. He's not going to issue an apology. He's not going to address that issue, but he is going to talk, I'm sure, about the need for a negotiated step-by-step process where we get to a non-nuclear world. And that, I think, is the sort of hidden agenda in his trip. I can't imagine why he would go to Hiroshima for any other reason. It's such a sensitive and highly symbolic city.
Well, Kai Bird, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Kai Bird, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and journalist, whose books include The Good Spy, The Life and Death of Robert Ames, and American Prometheus, The Triumph and Tragedy of J. Robert Oppenheimer. He has authored numerous critical writings on the Vietnam War, Hiroshima, nuclear weapons, and the Cold War, among other subjects. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.